Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the war on gold right after this. If you're earning $50,000 a year and you pay all of your 14 taxes, you get to keep about 40% of what you create and produce. Government gets the other 60%. That's $20,000 for you and $30,000 for the government. Now, isn't that just kind of real special? And if you think that your share isn't enough for you, then why don't you work twice as hard and produce twice as much and make $100,000 next year? Then go ahead and pay your same 14 taxes just like you did this year. And you're going to net about 25%, and the government will net 75%. Now, that means that for working twice as hard and producing twice as much, you'll get $4,000 more. That's an 8% increase in net take-home pay, 8% more than you got this year. After you produced 100% more, you get 8% of it. Now, that's guaranteed by Congress and the IRS. That's why I contend that there ought to be something more intelligent for you and I to do than to put ourselves into the top 5% of income earners and then only get 25% of it. Now, why don't you call today and order my free 4-hour CD package and let me tell you how to deal with that kind of crime. It's 4 hours of entertaining information, and it'll answer many of your legal questions about taxes and why it is that we pay so much and receive so little. Now, to order that free general law CD package, just call direct and ask for it. It's 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967, or you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. And remember, our tax and status school is also available on compact disc for adult homeschooling. The number to call, 417-273-4967 or georgegordon.org. All right, we've been talking about this thing of the war on gold. I get a lot of mail and a lot of requests from people wanting to know, how in the world does the Plunge Protection Team fit in here? How does the government fit in? Why is the government so opposed to gold? Or how do they manipulate the price of gold? Should I buy gold? Why should I buy gold? What's wrong with paper money? You know, people have questions, and we try to answer those questions, and from time to time I take a look at those questions and boil it down and say, well, maybe we ought to have a little class 101 here, gold 101, and let's see if we can't understand this thing of gold. Gold's been around for thousands of years. People have been using gold and silver and barter and trade, and great empires have come and gone, and in every single case, when you see the demise of a great empire, it's after they have debased their money. It's after they have gone off of gold and gone into paper or gone into base metal, or they have adopted a system of unjust weights and balances. And in every single case, when you look at the rise of a great empire like the Roman Empire, the Egyptians, the Babylonians, the Greeks, the Assyrians, it's after they established a hard money gold and silver exchange rate. I can't find any exceptions to that. The United States of America adopted gold and silver in 1792 with the Coinage Act of 1792, and in 100 years, we were the dominant nation, the dominant political, economic, and military power in the world by 1900. 100 years later, we're it. It went on for a little while, and in 1950, we decided to go off onto this fiat currency thing, and from 1950 to 2000, 50 years, we threw it all away. We have gone from being the world's number one creditor nation 50 years ago until today we're the world's number one debtor nation. Now, that's a sudden about-face. Now, we threw it away, and we threw it away for a reason. And that's because political power in the hands of people doesn't work. Democracy doesn't work. It never has, doesn't now, and isn't going to in the future. And the creator of the universe, God Almighty, is not a Democrat. That's why I always tell my students Moses was a Republican. Kind of in jest, I would say. But the God of the universe is not a guy that's running for political office, and he's not seeking your vote. He doesn't care whether you approve of him or disapprove of him. He didn't even ask you the question. In Numbers chapter 16, there's a cute story in there about a guy named Korah. And he challenged Moses. He said, hey, Moses, you know, you're nothing but a damn dictator here. You're nothing but an autocrat. And what we need is a loyal opposition. We need a division of political power. We need a power-sharing program. Moses didn't know quite how to handle it. And so he went to God and he said, hey, we got this guy Korah over here, and he's disenchanted here with the governmental apparatus. He doesn't like this monarchy thing over here. I think he wants to establish a democracy. And God said, Moses, you go tell Korah that we'll have an election, at 2:30 this afternoon. You tell him to get his censors out. And there's 250 of these guys. These were called the princes of each of Israel. There's 250 of them on that side. There's just Aaron and Moses on this side, but there's 250 on the other side. And the majority of the people supported Korah. So it wasn't like, you know, the majority of the people were behind Moses. They hated Moses. Moses was about as popular as Adolf Hitler in London during the Blitz. I mean, that just they didn't care for him at all. And so at about 2:30 in the afternoon, the Korah guys, they got out there with their censers and they lit them up. And Moses and Aaron lit up theirs, and they were on the other side of this little valley thing. And God had told Moses, he warned him ahead of time, he says, now you get as far away from that Korah guy as you can get. And then there was an earthquake and the ground opened up and swallowed up Korah and his 250 guys and 14,800 people with all of their camels, dogs, chickens, horses and cows, everything they had, including their wives, children and little babies sucking on their mommy's breast. All went down into the hole, closed it up, and God said, well, the election is over and the results are known and the will of God has now clearly been shown. God ain't a Democrat. So that's what God thinks of democracy. And God also has a plan for gold and silver coin. He has a monetary system in mind, and he's the guy that came up with this monetary system based upon gold and silver. And then, of course, a lot of very wise men have come along over the years, politicians, economists, and others, and they've come up with all kinds of neat systems for buying, selling, and trading. All kinds of metals and all kinds of paper and all kinds of credit cards, and, you know, you name it, and somebody's come up with it. And it works well for a select few. Primarily the bankers and politicians love this soft money, paper money system. And the people don't know what to like. They just do whatever they're told. And God, he kind of likes the hard money, gold and silver system. And so when the bankers come along and they come up with, you know, four-color press advertisements and neat ads on the CBS Evening News, they buy into it. The people will buy into whatever it is that somebody's selling, especially if it's anti-God, anti-Bible, or anti-Scripture. They'll buy into it. Well, that's what we did with free trade. This whole thing of internationalism and free trade over here is the exact opposite from what we see in the Scripture, which deals with nationalism and closed borders, hard money. Look out for yourself. To hell with the Chinese. Now, that's a wild new idea, you know, for Americans, but I just thought I'd share it with you. Gold has a key role in the construction of this new world order. And dollar imperialism requires supremacy of the dollar. But the dollar is inconvertible paper, and it can be challenged by gold and only by gold. And the major producers of gold are Russia, the Soviet Union, which at the moment presents no real threat to the United States because of its technical dependence, and South Africa, which is a threat because receipts of its gold sales are only slightly influenced by Wall Street's ambitions. So in 1976, there were two countries that posed a problem to the Wall Street bankers and the New World Order. The first was the Soviet Union, which was a large gold producer, and South Africa, which is a large gold producer, but the internationalists controlled the Soviet Union through technology but didn't control South Africa. So the solution for South Africa is it had to be destroyed. And boys and girls, 30 years later, in 2006, South Africa has been destroyed. Its gold production is in decline. South Africa's population is now 25%, 1 in 4, HIV positive. Did they succeed? Oh, beyond their wildest expectations. The Soviet Union disintegrated, South Africa has been destroyed, and the New World Order is on track, and here we go. South Africa is becoming increasingly independent of the United States, and it is doing so deliberately as a matter of survival. By contrast, the Soviet Union, with its perennial crop failures and its continuing heavy technological requirements, is becoming more dependent on the West every day, particularly the United States. And consequently, South Africa is an unwitting barrier to the New World Order. Now, when Mozambique was seized by Marxists, the United States did nothing to hinder the change of power, although it was careful to preserve its anti-Marxist public image. When Angola fell to the Marxists, the United States again made a pretense of support and sympathy for the non-Marxist side, but that was all. We know from historical experience that economic and financial conflict can be a prelude to physical conflict. Even without subscribing to the Marxist economic theory of class war and dollar imperialism, we can cite the Mafeking raid and the Angola Boer War in South Africa, both of which were heavily influenced by the gold and diamond discoveries of the late 19th century in South Africa. Now, could the war on gold then escalate into a U.S. attack on South Africa to control an independent gold source and an irritable challenge to the New World Order? Or, alternatively, and more easily disguised from the American public, might the United States encourage the Soviet Union to move against South Africa? Well, from the evidence presented in Chapter 11, it seems Henry Kissinger and his friends have been doing precisely that. From the establishment viewpoint, a gold supply, even under Soviet influence, would be preferred to one controlled by an independent South Africa. The Soviet Union is dependent on the United States for wheat and advanced technology and uses gold to pay for these supplies. South Africa is not dependent upon the United States for anything. Consequently, ownership of South African gold would enable the Soviet Union to become an even greater market for Western technology, and in brief, the United States could eliminate its troublesome gold problem and gain a rich new captive market overnight, or within the 130 days, which the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace estimates that it would require to occupy South Africa. Now, this may sound fantastic, but perhaps not so fantastic to readers outside of the United States. There are signs even now of the implementation of such a policy. And as we noted in Chapter 11, in 1965, the tax-exempt Carnegie Endowment for International Peace issued a report categorizing the military forces needed for such an attack upon South Africa by France, West Germany, the Soviet Union, the United Kingdom, and the United States. If this indeed is a hidden policy of the United States, then one critical observation appears to have escaped our establishment planners, and that is, presuming that they are not intentionally planning our or their destruction, every major civilization in history has been based upon the control of most of the available gold supply. Let's underline that. Every civilization in history, that's the Roman Empire, the Greeks, Egyptians, Babylonians, Assyrians, the Romans, the Americans, the French, everybody, their civilization in history has been based upon the control of most of the available gold supply, and we briefly describe a few illustrations of this fact of history in Chapter 1. Then there was the 16th century Spanish Empire, based on control of most of the world's then known gold mines. The British Empire was at its most powerful when it controlled the world's gold mines in South Africa, Canada, and Australia. In recent decades, the United States has controlled the world's largest stockpile of gold, with reserves equal to 12 years of South African output. Now let's look into the future. Soviet planners are not naive Keynesians or bemused detenteurs. The Soviet planners are blunt, ruthless realists. They recognize the simple equation. South African gold plus Russian gold equals nearly the total world supply, which equals total world control. Now, Wall Street may think that the USSR is a safe technical captive of dollar imperialism, and it is. But it may well be that Wall Street and the rest of the non-communist, half-heartedly free enterprise world that ends up as a captive of Russian imperialism on this vital point, the U.S. may have miscalculated. Now, in the past, any academic who dared to stress the implications of technical subsidy of the Soviet Union and our ideological and illogical gold policy has been scorned and harassed. But why is that? Because the establishment does not have the skills to plan and analyze. It hires those skills. And mostly, those skills that they hire are self-promoting academics who suppress any evidence that is contrary to their belief. Those academics who stick to their last, which is teaching and research, are not going to be found near the power centers on a permanent basis. Occasionally, perhaps, they will be temporary and reluctant advisors. But it is the Henry Kissingers and the Rostos and the Rusks who are found at the power centers. The advice they give suffers from the same deficiencies as their personal makeup. They are not well-founded in empirical knowledge, and they lack a certain toughness of fiber. They tend to advise what is wanted or what the establishment client wants to hear. So their recommendations, based on faulty premises and ignorance and implemented hesitantly and half-heartedly, often fails. Have these academic sociophants misread the most logical result of their policies? We cannot say with certainty, and we hope that we will not learn the truth ex post facto. In the final analysis, the international war on gold is a war for the gold output of South Africa, the world's largest producer. And apparently the United States is quite willing to see South Africa led, blindfolded, to the wall, and destroyed. And why is that? Well, in part at least because the Keynesian bright boys in Washington have no concept of gold as a store of value, as money. And in foreign policy, the Kissinger bright boys are neither as tough nor as shrewd as the Soviet planners. And perhaps the establishment believes it can control the Soviets by using U.S. technology as a carrot, or, heaven forbid, as a stick, with American technical supremacy used as the world's peacemaker. There's no way the United States can control the USSR merely through transfers of technology for reasons too complex to analyze here. Now, we have then reached our final conclusion, the distillation of our discussion. The fate of South Africa, the world's largest gold producer, is also the fate of the United States. This conclusion may be repugnant to many persons whose assessments of South Africa are made from a distance of 10,000 miles or more, and whose closest proximity to a gold mine has been the United Nations Plaza in New York City. But let the reader be assured, however, that if South African gold falls or is pushed into Marxist hands, either directly or indirectly, then at some point down the road, there will be no more Wall Street establishment, and there will be no more United States of America as a free society. And this will be an inexorable, and it will be an inevitable consequence of this war on gold. Now, I'm going to put a bracket around that paragraph. because that's where we are today in 2006. We're on the precipice of the destruction of America's freedoms. Now, this guy, Saddam Hussein, he wanted to trade his oil for euros. He refused. He wanted to opt out of the dollar hegemony of dollars buying gold. And so he didn't join the International Monetary Fund. He was kind of an outcast. He was a CIA asset. You'll remember back in the 80s, it was the same Donald Rumsfeld who went over to Baghdad and gave him all the weapons of mass destruction to use against the Iranians. Now, can you see why the Iranians hate our guts? We're over here backing Saddam Hussein with nerve gas and toxic poisons and weapons of mass destruction. We made enemies of the Iranians, and now we're over here threatening the Iranians with a nuclear war if they continue down the road of nuclear proliferation. All at the same time, while we're involved in a war with Iraq and with Afghanistan. The Afghanistanis, by the way, the Taliban, they didn't have to have a problem with the United States. The Unocal company wanted to put an oil line across Afghanistan to sell oil from the Caspian Sea to India. And the Taliban said, no way, Jose. And so they said, what we need is a regime change. And you got it. You got it. Now, children, let's understand that gold is a very important element. You may not think so. Now, take a look at South Africa. It's now in Marxist hands. It has been destroyed. And the nation to the north of it used to be called Rhodesia. They call it Zimbabwe now. They used to export food from Rhodesia. South Africa was a first world country, an industrial power. It's now been destroyed. And it's in decline. Rhodesia is importing food, and they're facing starvation. They have about 1,000% inflation rate there. Now, the blacks, they hate white rule. I hope they're happy with Mugabe, and I hope they're happy in South Africa with the Marxists. Now, if you take a look at their standard of living under Marxism and under African or black rule, it's the pits. They've lost ground. But evidently, they would prefer to be ruled over by a black tyrant than to be ruled over by a white tyrant. I think that's where the Iraqis are. We would rather have a Saddam Hussein tyrant than we would a George Bush tyrant. That's the way people are. Now, if our establishment puts its fate and ours in the hands of anti-gold academians and political planners, then they and we will pay a price, a big price. In warring on gold, the United States is flirting with a doomsday demise of all American dreams by tacitly subsidizing the Soviet mission in Africa, which is almost certainly aimed at South Africa's mineral wealth. The United States is writing finish to its own promises for human liberty, and it is condemning the world to a Soviet imperialism that allows no dissent and no objections. Boys and girls, both Rhodesia and South Africa are in the communist camp. Of course, that doesn't say much for the United States. We're in the communist camp also. But, you know, we're still claiming that we're anti-communist at the same time we send our children to public school. We claim to be anti-communist at the same time we pay the second plank's income tax and use the fifth plank's Federal Reserve notes and send our 16% off to Maryland under Social Security, which is the eighth plank. I mean, we practice all 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto and call ourselves capitalists. God, you talk about mass public propaganda. Now, it's not too late to call off a war in which the United States will be an even greater loser than South Africa. There is still time to restore integrity to our monetary policies and sanity to our foreign policies, but there's not much time, and once the pages of history are turned past our own point of no return, there is no second chance. There will be no appeal to a higher court. It's now or never. Now, remember, this is in 1976. Now, we didn't take that now or never challenge, and we went on with more and more paper and less gold, and we finally got to the point where South Africa went into captivity to the Marxists, along with Rhodesia. And we've now spent ourselves into a box, a black hole, in which Americans now are spending $800 billion a year on imports and exporting $200 billion a year. Well, that's a deficit of $600 billion a year. This is a lifestyle that we've all become accustomed to. Well, there's an ultimate end to that, you know. Just ask yourself, if you were the Chinese, if you were running China, and the United States hands you over some papers that says, here, we want to buy your big screen TVs, we want to buy steel and automobiles and tennis shoes from you, and here's the way we want to pay you, with pieces of paper. And you're Chinese now, and you've stocked up. You've got $600 billion worth of this paper over here. Is there ever a time when you might want to go spend that paper money? Well, the Chinese did. A couple years ago, they said, well, we would like to buy an oil company. So they came to the United States and said, okay, now we sold you the television sets, and we work hard for you, and we sold you the tennis shoes, and you gave us these papers. So we have this in our savings account. Now we want to take $20 billion out of our savings account, and we want to buy this oil company. And the United States Congress went into executive session and said, no way, Jose, that's a national security interest, and you cannot buy Union Oil Company. Let me try it this way. Let's suppose that you were working for me, and you stocked your money up in your savings account, And you came to me and said, hey, Gordon, I want to buy that cow over there. And I said, no way. You can buy rocks and broken bottles and bricks, and you can buy other trash and trinkets, but you can't buy anything that's worthwhile, like, you know, a cow or a horse or an acre of land. That's off limits to you guys. Yet, you know, when your money won't buy what you want to buy, of what value is it? Would you continue to do that? Would you continue to sell to some guy that won't let you spend your money with him? Pays you in worthless paper, takes your valuable assets, and then gives you worthless pieces of paper in return? Well, I wouldn't. And we hope that the Chinese are real dumb and they'll just continue to do that forever. We hope that you Chinese over there are real stupid and you just keep taking our paper and working real hard for us and give us all your hard goods. Would you people just do that? Sit down, shut up, and just be our servants, would you? I'm afraid, kids, that those people over there aren't as dumb as we think they are. And then, and I'm just a crummy plumber here, and I'm just reading these papers that I see on my shelf over here concerning the New World Order and their plans. And I see they're going to exterminate all the Chinese and all the blacks. Did you suppose that maybe those Chinese are stupid and can't read English, and maybe they don't know that? You think maybe they might have heard through the grapevine that there might be a plan that doesn't include them, and maybe they need to take action? I'm kind of suspicious. And in Deuteronomy 28, our God, you know, the God that we give the finger to constantly, gave us a piece of advice. He said, the stranger that's within your gates is going to rise up high above you and bring you down very low. And your enemies that hate you are going to attack you, break down your strong towers and your high-fenced walls, and take your wives and your children and kill them in front of your eyes, and then kill you on top of it. He said, a nation from afar whose language you do not understand, a people of fierce countenance. Sounds awfully Chinese to me. A people of fierce countenance. And then when you take a look at America and what we did to the Hawaiians, and then you take a look at America and then you see what we did to Nicaragua, El Salvador, Venezuela, Colombia, Panama, Mexico twice, and then you take a look at our 737 military bases occupying 126, I believe, or 127 countries around the world. And then you take a look at the way we have stolen the Arabs' oil in the Middle East. I don't know, kids. It just sounds like to me that we don't have very many friends in the world, and that those people that we've oppressed and stolen from and lied to and cheated and overthrown their governments, etc., might, and just might, if they got the opportunity, stick it to us. It's always been a bother to me. Those guys might stick it to us. I'm not sure that the Chinese are our buddies. And, you know, the Russians, you know, they act like such nice guys over there, but I'm not really sure that the Russians are really our buddies either. And they still have a lot of nukes. Now, remember I told you the other day that the way we read this book is we start at the back, so we read you the last chapter, then we took off here about the middle and we took a look at another chapter, and then and now it says, let's go up here to chapter 1 and find out, what's this thing all about? What's the question? We got the answer. And we found out why of the answer. Now we need to find out, well, what the hell was the question? And that's called chapter 1. Why gold? No state shall make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts. That comes from the Constitution of the United States, Article 1, Section 10. But you know, for a long time we didn't have gold and silver. And if nothing, you know, no state shall make anything but, then how come we got Federal Reserve notes, checks, and credit cards? See, our founding fathers, they followed God's instruction that you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag. But then we decided to change. We got about halfway through our history and we said, hey, we need to change here. George Washington didn't know about separation of church and state, but thank God Earl Warren came on the scene with Warren Burger and figured out that what we need here is a separation of church and state and morality. What we need is to teach our daughters to be whores and our sons to be sodomites, and we need to do that in the public schools, and we got right after it, and that's what we're doing. That's why I wonder why you Americans send your children to the Communist Manifesto's 10th plank, public schools, to give them a free education in sodomy and whoredom. Would seem like to me that you would opt out of the system and educate your children at home and follow those educational precepts and principles that God gave us in the scripture. Six scriptures, six statutes that tell you to educate your own child to this law in the Bible and do it at home. But for some reason, we have about 47 million children in public school, about 2 or 3 million children in homeschool, and an undetermined amount in parochial school. I never have gotten a number on these parochial schools, but I would guesstimate it's probably 5 or 6 million. But the overwhelming majority of children are being educated in the mass media, Soviet-style, communist-ideological public school system. So it shouldn't be any big mystery, boys and girls, why it is that America has adopted communism and thrown the Ten Commandments out of our schools and public institutions. I mean, you've been teaching your children to do that now for the last 75 or 80 years. And it worked. In May of 1973, corporate money managers, treasury and government officials, academic theorists, and politicians around the world picked up their local newspapers to read that gold on the free London market had broken through the almost incredible figure of $100 an ounce. That was in May of 73. $100 an ounce. By contrast, on the official market established by government decree, the price of gold was pegged at $42.22 an ounce, and the professional money managers in Washington considered even $42.22 too high for this residue of financial primitivism. The professional money planners must indeed have felt uncomfortable. After all, for decades they had boldly averred in speeches and academic articles that gold was an unnecessary hangover. It was a barbaric relic. That's what Lord Keynes said from less sophisticated times. In this modern world of computers and business school techniques, we had no further need for gold in our managed economies, or so they had argued. Contemporary monetary columnists and pundits repeatedly stressed gold's gloomy future, its role in world affairs. Sylvia Porter was certain will be, and she said, it will be a minor one, and the role will become smaller, for gold is to be deliberately phased out of the monetary system over the years ahead, completing the process begun in Genoa in 1922. And here was gold busting exuberantly past $100 an ounce, and it was a showing rarely matched by pork bellies or plywood futures. Establishment journals and media reporting in the United States put the best face possible on a disturbing situation. Business Week reiterated that, yes, gold was dead, but it admitted that obviously a lot of people around the world still had faith in gold and much less faith in paper money. For several thousand years, the world has thought of gold as money. For several hundred years, it has lived increasingly on credit and still thought of gold as money. It will take some adjustment to think of paper money as the only money and gold as just like pork bellies. As Business Week noted, gold has been thought of as money, usually as a store of value, less commonly for exchange purposes, almost since the dawn of civilization. And gold was used even before silver, although silver was more common, because native silver is rare, and the metallurgical skills required to extract silver metal from complex ores came later than the discovery of simple or simpler gold smelting techniques. While gold in early times was too scarce and therefore too valuable to use in day-to-day transactions, ancient civilizations in Egypt, China, Persia, and Babylon, almost without exception, left a record of their use of gold as a store of value. The historical evidence suggests that a paper money system can work for exchange purposes only if the option exists for conversion into gold. Never in history has an inconvertible paper system succeeded without a gold backing, but it is the store of value function of gold that is also historically important. This function is unwisely ignored by modern economists and politicians. Notice here, it's never happened in history, but we Americans are busily getting after it. We're going to make paper money replace gold. Well, let me give you a reminder here that the Law Hour and Editorial Review is what you're listening to here on the, you're listening rather to the Law Hour and Editorial Review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. And the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. It can be accessed through the webpage. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. And the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that those authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications cited on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily entirely or in total endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, talking about gold, The War on Gold. It's a book written by Anthony Seton back in 1976 called The War on Gold. To get a copy, go to a used bookstore, plug into the internet, and find a bookstore somewhere that's got one. Now, notice here that Seton predicted that South Africa would become Marxist, or that it would go Marxist or communist. It did. As a result of that, the United States would follow suit, and that it, too, would be an empire in decline, and we are. And now we went through the Vietnam War, and we lost to an insurgency. We're now going through the Iraq War, and we're about to lose to an insurgency. We're on the cusp now. We are in debt up over our eyeballs. It's $150 trillion is what we Americans owe if we went out to pay off all of our debts, all of our sureties. Hell, boys and girls, if you sold everything in the country, you couldn't raise $150 trillion. If you sold all the land, all the cars, all the plants, all the houses, all the people, you couldn't raise $150 trillion. And that's because everything in the world is only worth about $100 trillion. Everything in the world, $100 trillion. And so America is in a hawk up over our eyebrows. We can't pay off. And we have pledged collateral for that money, those notes. And it's about to come due. And there's going to be some foreclosures, and there's going to be some dislocations in our economy. A lot of property is going to change hands here shortly. And then we're just telling you ahead of time so that when your property changes hands and you get wiped out, you'll know why. I didn't come here to save you. I came here to tell you here's why it's happening to you. Now, our God gave us a certain standard, and he said, I don't want you using unjust weights and balances. We wrote it into our Constitution in 1787. This paper money is strictly unconstitutional, but then, you know, most of us don't give a rat's you-know-what concerning our Constitution. We just go out and do it anyway. Now, we've all been guilty of this, and we all participated in the credit cards and the good times and the parties and the partying, and we used the Federal Reserve notes and the mortgages and the second deeds of trust and all of the goodies that go along with it, and so now that we're drunk and now that we've had a good time, there's a hangover coming. There's a sobering up process ahead of us. That sobering up process is not going to be fun. Now, why gold has been accepted as money without question for several thousand years cannot be appreciated without looking at the unique role performed by gold as money and the alternatives to gold. Why has gold been universally accepted as money, and why have people distinguished between gold and almost all other commodities? Why is gold unique as a store of value and as a medium of exchange? We need first to look at history before we look further at today's war on gold. We know that the Chinese used gold and silver from about 1200 B.C. onward. Egypt used gold from about 1000 B.C. onward. Babylon and Minoa from at least the 3rd century B.C. Byzantium achieved an extraordinary record of 800 years of monetary stability and prosperity with a gold coinage. Significantly, there was a remarkable uniformity of the standards of weight and of gold coins used in these ancient empires. Widely separated localities over thousands of years in time had almost the same weight gold coins. And we would perhaps expect coins to be portable and large enough not to be lost in transit. But the uniformity was more precise than limits of overweight and underweight for transport. This uniformity is a vital reflection of the intuitive and universal confidence that gold commands. In 1892, William Ridgway listed the gold coin weight standards of these ancient empires as follows. So the gold coins of Egypt, called the gold ring, the Mycenaean, the Homeric talent, or ox unit, the Attic gold stater, Thasos, Rhodes, Cyzicus, the Hebrew standard, Persian, Macedonian, Bactrian, Indian standard, Phoenician gold, Carthaginian, Sicily and Lower Italy, Etruscan, Gaulish, and German. All of these city-states, these empires of the past, used gold coins, and the gold coins weighed 120 grains to 140 grains. They were all within 20 grains of one another. And almost all of them were around 130 to 135 grains. Over a period of 3,000 years. Isn't that just special? So in brief, ancient gold coins were almost precisely uniform in weight. They ranged only between 120 grains for Carthaginian, German, and Gaulish coins to 135 grains for the Attic and Macedonian staters. The Homeric talent of the Persian Derrick were 130 grains. Other ancient gold coins varied only between the limits of 120 and 140 grains. So why was there this remarkable uniformity over several thousand years when communications were slow and cities widely separated? Well, A.R. Burns suggests that the constant weight originated at one trading center, either in Egypt or Chaldea, and immigrants and merchants carried coins to more distant parts where the weight was duplicated in other coins. The important point here is that these ancient gold coins were widely accepted in primitive times because of the weight of gold that they were known to contain. And it was the physical qualities of gold, the known content of gold of a particular fineness, and the fact that coinage could not easily be expanded in supply or debased and or counterfeited, and the durability of gold that made gold universally acceptable. Gold had generated the all-important monetary prerequisite of confidence. Confidence that it would maintain its value. And we shall see later that this psychological attribute of confidence is at the heart of the acceptability of all money, whether it's paper or hard. Even in ancient times, with primitive communications among vastly different peoples and customs, gold coins generated worldwide confidence. The requirement of confidence led to the adoption of similar coinage standards, and so similar units of weight evolved independently in different geographical areas. Full weight was essential for confidence, and confidence was essential for coinage to circulate. Debasement by clipping or reducing the fineness was known but rarely adopted until medieval times. And in fact, debasement of the coinage could hardly exist in ancient communities not far removed from barter, which continued to barter and trade coins by weight concurrently after a monetary system was introduced. Now, in more modern societies, money is well integrated into the fabric of the economy, subject to political propaganda and decision-making. And so debasement and manipulation is difficult to isolate and recognize. It is so common and widespread. Thus, there exists a temptation for the state to depreciate its coinage for quick profit and to disguise the theft, the depreciation, with a propaganda barrage. Recognizing the essential requirement of confidence, ancient empires kept the value of their money constant for long periods of time without debasement. In the Persian Empire, debasement occurred only in its declining years, and even then took the form of a reduction in fineness to prevent export rather than political juggling with the metal content. In the Greek world, gold coins were almost always pure gold. Late in the Greek era, the Greeks invented plated coins, but plated coins did not masquerade as genuine full weight and fineness gold coins. The Macedonian Empire maintained a pure coinage almost to the end. Only in the later Roman Empire did debasement constitute deliberate government policy. Gold coins of the Roman Republic were almost always pure. After Augustus and the founding of the Roman Empire in 15 BC, gold coins suffered progressive debasement under the strain of war and corrupt governments. But it was not until the Roman Empire that the various techniques for coinage debasement were used widely and used on a large scale. The Eastern empires of China, Persia, and Egypt were notable for their almost complete absence of debasement or devaluation until more modern times, with the exception of Chinese paper money, which we shall describe below. Now, if in May of 1973, Treasury officials and establishment pundits had known more of monetary history and a whole lot less of their grandiose plans for this new world order, they would not have been surprised when gold burst through $100 an ounce. Those immutable qualities that made gold acceptable in ancient times are still deeply embedded in the human psyche today. Now notice this paragraph. I'm going to put a bracket around it here. I'm on page 21. Listen to this. He says, in May of 1973, Treasury officials and establishment pundits, if they had known more of monetary history and less of their grandiose plans for a new world order. Remember, this is written back in 1976. So this new world order plan has been around for a while. In fact, it's written right on our dollar bills. It goes back to 1776. And then on your dollar bill, that little statement you see on that pyramid over there is a statement that is designed for and is used among the adepts for their plan for a new world order. You know, it says, Anet Cypries. And then down here at the bottom, it's got a little Latin term here on the bottom. And then see if I can read that. See if I can see it here. Get my loop on here. It says Novus Ordo Seclorum, New World Order. Hey, these guys have been around for a while, and they've had this plan cooking for a while. Now their plan can't work, doesn't work, and won't work unless you and I participate in it. You know, if everybody in the United States of America did what I do, or better yet, did what God instructed us to do, the banks would all go out of business tomorrow at 8 o'clock in the morning. And do you know why? They wouldn't have any customers. You know, I don't have a credit card or a bank account. I don't do business with banks, period. I don't have any insurance, and I don't do business with insurance companies. So all of the insurance companies would go out of business. We would have no more limited liability. The only thing left then would be strict liability. We would be in compliance with the strict liability requirements of the Mosaic Law, and we would be in compliance with most, not all, but with most of the economic law of the Scripture. Now, isn't that just real special? Two of the biggest debilitating institutions in our economy, banks and insurance, would be eliminated if we just quit supporting them. They can't survive without us. Boys and girls, those are parasitic institutions. Parasites need a host. Hosts don't need parasites. Dogs don't need ticks, but ticks need dogs. You know, I'll just leave it to you. You can decide what you want to do. But for my money, I don't think I'll support the banks and the insurance companies. I saw a cute bumper sticker here. It's been around for a while. It says, don't vote. It just encourages them. But that's about the truth. What if nobody voted? What if nobody followed the edicts or the laws of the United States? What if everybody followed the instruction that we received in Leviticus 18, verses 1 through 5? God told us plainly, he says, do not practice the law of the United States. Do not practice the law of Maryland. Don't practice the law of Texas. You practice my law. What would happen to the governments of Texas and Maryland? What would happen to the governors and the highway patrol and all of the politicians and all of the public bureaucrats? What would happen to all of the ticks and chiggers that run those governments? They wouldn't have a host. And they would all starve to death. They would all disappear. You know, God had a pretty neat plan. Now, this paper money in ancient China, you know, in many innovations, the Chinese anticipated the Western world. Their abuse of paper fiat currency is one such instance. The first European use of paper banknotes was recorded in Sweden in 1661. By contrast, Marco Polo in his travels found the Chinese had been using paper money in the 13th century. And the Venetian traveler and explorer presents the following admiring account of the paper money system created by Kublai Khan. In the 13th century. Kublai Khan. Paper money. Quite a little story. We'll take that up next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review when we get to the Chinese paper money experiment. And it didn't work then. It hasn't worked in China, and they've tried it several times. It didn't work in Japan, and they've tried it several times. It hasn't worked in America, and we've tried it twice. It didn't work in Britain. It hasn't worked anywhere in continental Europe. If any of you people out there know where paper money has ever worked, would you let me know? Send me an email, send me a letter, call me on the phone, and say, hey, listen, you overlooked this. Look at where paper money has succeeded. Gold, the barbaric relic, has been overthrown. I'd like to know about it, and I'll report on it. Meanwhile, back on the farm, the record shows there haven't been any successes, so let's take a look at the failure of the Chinese next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. That's next time. But in the meantime, you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Hey, our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, talking about this war on gold. And so until then, thanks for listening, everybody. And good night, friends.